Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk, WATD. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
I'm Kevin Tachi. It is Christine James, but I am glad to be here after commandeering this portion of Monday Night Talk. But Kevin Tachi's right next to me.
Hi.
Hello. And Charles Matheson is right next to me as well.
Well, hello again.
Hello, this is part two of our political forum, and right now we're talking about the state Senate seat for Plymouth and Bourne. We've got the two candidates here. We've got the Republican incumbent, Vinny DiMaceo, and his challenger, Democrat Deb Rudolph. Thanks for joining us so much.
Thank you.
And then again, we do have the folks from Whitman-Hanson Community Access filming this, and our own Amy Leonard, who has your time cards there. See those big sheets of construction paper? You probably haven't seen those since about, I don't know, kindergarten. And we find this works very well with candidates. Green means go, red means stop, and yellow means you have 10 seconds. Now, if you start to speak into the red, you see me do like this. This means you get the 5-second grace period. But if you talk over, you get the bell. We find this keeps people on the straight and narrow and keeps things moving here for radio. Now, if you're not sure if you live in the district with the Plymouth Barnstable State Senate seat, that's Bourne, Falmouth, Kingston, Pembroke, Plymouth, and Sandwich. We're going to use the same format we use every time for every one of these political forums. We have asked the candidates to have opening statements prepared no longer than 2 minutes, closing statements too, no longer than 1 minute. Now, we will ask, we being the reporters, will ask a round of questions, and then we'll also ask some lightning round questions where the answers are either yes or no, or one or two sentences tops. And if you've listened to these on a regular basis, you see it's very difficult for anyone running to office to say yes or no, or one or two sentences tops, but we do try. Now, we chose the opening order and closing order out of our non-official WATD newsroom koozie because that has disappeared, but we hope to find it. Maybe the other one disappeared once for 6 months, but we'll get it back. So we're going to open with Deb Rudolph, then we're going to go to Vinny DiMaceo, and then we're going to reverse this order at the end. So let's say good evening and welcome and get our opening statement now from Deb Rudolph.
Thank you very much, Christine, and Kevin and Charlie. We're very happy to be here. I'm very happy to have this opportunity. I am Deb Rudolph, and I am running for this state Senate position based on the depth and breadth of my experience in the real world. I'm an elder law attorney. I've worked as a teacher with preschoolers. I've worked with the elderly. I've had a small business in which I consulted with many businesses because I was an itinerant bookkeeper, so I walked around, and it gives me a good financial background, as well as working with taxes for people. I have been working as an advocate for the most vulnerable for my entire life, from infants and toddlers in abusive situations to elders being abused to social justice issues like same-sex marriage, and of course now the transgender rights bill. I've been a tireless advocate, and I believe that that's what gives me the strength to really go up and really be a new voice and a new face. I'm not a career politician. I'm a person from the people to bring the people's voice up to Beacon Hill.
Thank you very much. That was the opening statement from Deb Rudolph. Now let's go to Vinny DiMaceo, your opening statement.
Thank you, Christine, and to WATD, and to Kevin and Charlie. We appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I want to thank my opponent as well for being and participating in the political process. It's important for us to be able to have a debate, and by her being involved, we're able to do that. I want to say that 4 years ago, I asked the people of the Plymouth and Barnstable District if they would give me an opportunity to serve them on Beacon Hill, that I would be honest, that I would be hardworking, and that I would be effective. And I believe that I've lived up to that commitment. I promised them that I would work on issues that were important to them. And there's three issues that are important here, north of the bridge, and three issues that are more important and over the bridge. And so in this area, again, and I think universally, and my opponent and I agree on this, is the opioid crisis, probably the biggest issue that we're facing. I had the privilege and honor of being on that conference committee that created the first piece of legislation, which frankly I think is a model for the entire nation in regards to how we address that. And since then, we've tried to do things to make it a little bit better and try to strengthen that. And we've made some real progress there. Another big issue was the issue of the decommissioning of the nuclear power plant. Another issue that it was myself and Dan Wolf, a Democrat, who actually created the Nuclear Advisory Nuclear Decommissioning Advisory Panel. Say that five times fast. I worked together. And that panel has really put us in a much better position than we otherwise would have been. And that's something that I've had the privilege of working on and obviously creating the legislation to do that. And lastly, for this area, one of the biggest issues in this region is the Plymouth 400 and how we as a community are going to be prepared for having the spotlight of the entire nation and frankly the world upon us. And I've worked hard to bring in significant resources, as you heard earlier, over $16 million in state resources, federal, another $14 million, $1.2 million to run it. So with that, I hope that we can talk about other issues tomorrow.
Thank you very much. That was the opening statement from Vinny DiMacedo. Now let's go to Kevin Tachi, a question for the candidates.
State's economy has been growing over the past couple of years at a steady clip. Talk to me about how your district has benefited. Has it benefited a sufficient amount? What needs to be done to maintain this steady growth, whether it's a set of initiatives that the state should implement? Senator.
Of course, I think everyone's economy has done better over the past few years, and I think this last year probably the most significant 3.6% unemployment. We've seen a lot of building going on. As a small business owner myself, this has probably been one of the best years that I've had in business, so I think that it has worked. But the reality is there's things that we need to do to grow the economy. And so what can we do and what have I done? I've worked to try to work with the state to try to leverage Mass Works grants that help. In the town of Kingston, we're receiving a $3 million Mass Works grant to help water infrastructure, which is going to go specifically to the area where the old mall was, that is going to be able to open up for high-rise hotels there, as well as apartment buildings. I've worked to try to get Mass Works dollars specifically here. You look at Cordage Park, $2 million. That leveraged millions and millions of dollars of tax base, and that's the kind of thing that, you know, even though it's good, we need to build long-term infrastructure in place so it continues to grow, and I've tried to work on that.
Deb, same question, but my question to you is talk to me about the economy and how it's been growing. Do you feel that the district has received its fair share of benefit from this growth, and do you feel that there's something that the state needs to implement to maintain the growth and stimulate it further?
I think there are a couple of things in that regard. Yes, the economy has certainly benefited us as it has benefited the state as a whole, including we've seen the value of our homes rising. Of course, that also means that our tax bills have gone up commensurately with that, which is definitely creating a problem for elderly people who are trying to stay in their homes, and it's creating a problem for first-time home buyers down here. One of the things that we really need to do in this area, we have a huge tourism business down here. And the other really big business is our sand and gravel business. The sand and gravel business has done better, I think, because of all the building that's going on. But tourism has really suffered, and especially in the last couple of summers with losing our access to foreign students and foreign workers coming in. The Cape really suffered in terms of being able to fill the slots that they had for their hotel workers and restaurant workers, and we really need to get some relief on that end to really help people come up to that. I also think that we have to really build in job stability.
Okay. Let's go to Charles Mathewson now. Questions for the candidates.
First, I have a couple of disclosures to make. Both candidates and I are Plymouth residents, and in fact, Deb and I lived on the same street for a while. We dealt with a common traffic issue. Vinny and I took the polar plunge the first time that Jordan Hospital did it as a fundraiser for the cancer unit.
I'm still cold.
Yeah. Well, I noticed that I kept plunging, and you became the costume judge.
Somebody has to do it. Yeah. You're the judge.
Anyway, I hear from people, everyone likes Vinny. Vinny is a very likable person. And then they'll say, but he's so conservative, you know? And you're an immigrant. You and your brother have built businesses here. So I have to wonder, how do you align yourself with this anti-immigrant federal administration we have now?
Well, first of all, obviously, I love immigrants. I think the immigrants are what made this country so great. It's a melting pot. I've been the beneficiary of that. I certainly don't like the rhetoric I hear that seems to come across as anti-immigrant, because I believe, frankly, all of us have immigrant background, you know, short of the Native Americans that were here before. And so to that extent, I'm consistently trying to make sure that I make it clear. For me, it's about, you know, I've always been supportive of immigrants. But it doesn't mean that we totally throw away our immigration policy, because the reality is we do have to have an immigration policy. My family, you know, waited, and my mom, My grandparents came in 50. My grandparents came in 53. My grandfather died on the way over, but my grandmother got here. She had to bring every kid over one at a time, and my mother wasn't able to get here till 12. Till 12 years later. And it's because of immigration, you know, you had to wait your turn through the process. But we got here, we did it, and I think it's important that we support immigration, but we do keep the policy, you know, we have to have immigration laws, whether we like it or not, and we have to find that balance.
But you're a fairly conservative Republican, mm-hmm. and the current conservative Republican line is not what you're saying.
Well, and again, I'm sharing you with what I'm saying. I'm not aligning myself with anybody. I think that if you've seen what I've done over the years in regards to supporting immigrants, I've worked closely. You know, I was born in the Cape Verde Islands. I worked closely with them, with the Portuguese community. So if you look at it from that perspective, you know, I don't care what, you know, what they're doing at the federal level. To me, I'm concerned about what's happening here, and I try to be fair, and I try to, you know, share my background. And as an immigrant, I am so grateful that I and my six brothers and sisters were able to come to this great nation and have an opportunity. And I think there's a balance there. I don't like the rhetoric I hear. I think it's divisive, and I certainly don't participate in that.
Deb, where Vinny is a conservative Christian, you're a Unitarian, and you've said that if Vinny was successful in nullifying same-sex marriage, you wouldn't be married today. Are you part of this blue wave?
I certainly would like to think of myself as being part of this blue wave. Next week, I'll be celebrating my 13th wedding anniversary with my lovely wife, and I would not be doing that if the way the senator had voted when he was a state rep on the same-sex marriage issue. And still, 2 years ago, he voted no on the public accommodations bill for transgender people. So I think that's one of the places where we really have a significant difference. And it's not just about being able to celebrate anniversaries. It's about how you pay your taxes and what the level of taxation is that's levied against you. It's about whether you can be compelled to testify in court or not against your partner. It's about whether your children can get coverage from under your Social Security benefits. So there's over 1,000 different benefits and obligations that come along with being able to be legally married, that I think gay and lesbian people have lived with a long time before they were able to have those benefits.
I think you can probably both agree that there are some differences between the two of you.
Absolutely. And every day that, you know, I'm up on Beacon Hill, I deal with people. There's, as you know, predominantly 80% Democratic legislature, and I'm in the minority, albeit we have a Republican governor. But the reality is I deal with people that I disagree with all the time. But I think that I've earned the reputation, I think it's fair, that I've worked with anybody and everybody. I mean, Dan Wolf was probably one of the most progressive legislators on Beacon Hill as a senator. We've worked closely together and frankly like working together. And to be honest with you, I think I would enjoy working with you. You're passionate, you're hardworking as well, and I have a great deal of respect for you. And so it's not about, you know, what, you're going to disagree on issues. And as I shared earlier, I mean, I've probably taken over my 20 years probably 10,000 votes, and there are things that you're going to disagree with on and things you're going to agree on. But the reality is my heart has always been to fight for the people of this community and this district, and things that people care about. And that's what I've tried to do, and sometimes you're going to agree with me. The reality is you're going to make votes if you're given this opportunity that other people aren't going to be happy with.
Deb, how would you respond?
My response to that is that I agree, and I have a powerful and strong background in In conflict resolution and training in communications. I have trained people how to advocate for themselves. I would be a very strong advocate for the people of this district, and I think that I bring with my experience being, you know, with the real lives of real people. When I arrived in Massachusetts, I had $100 in my pocket, $100 in food stamps, a broken down car, a 9-month-old infant with a heart condition, no health insurance, and no work. I mean, I've worked my way up step by step by step, and I bring that perspective with having earned a lot of experience and really educating myself in terms of how to get the job done.
Thank you.
Both of you obviously have strong, passionate beliefs about things. I was thinking when you were talking about Lee Iacocca, talking about the fire in the belly. So if there's one issue or thing that drives you to want to serve your constituents, just one issue, tell me what it is. Let's start with you, Deb. In this election, what's the biggest issue for you that drives you to run for this office?
Healthcare. Being able to have access to healthcare, being able to have enough resources for healthcare, being able to afford healthcare. We are just facing an increasing crisis in this country with the changes that are coming down from Washington, and we really need to make sure that our legislators up in Beacon Hill are really going to continue to take steps like we already have to protect women's access to birth control. There are more and more of that coming along. Pre-existing conditions are at risk, and I think that we need to really be working towards universal health care.
Vinny, what's your one big fire in the belly issue for serving up Beacon Hill?
Okay, it used to be the economy and trying to grow the economy, because I believe that would put people in a better position. But over the years, it's evolved, and it has really become the opiate issue and the opiate crisis and how we deal with it. I just so often hear another story about, you open up the obituary, another young person dying, another young person dying. It is destroying the fabric of our society until we really get a control of that. And I know that we're doing better, and we're one of the few states in the entire nation that is actually seeing a downturn in opiate deaths and opiate overdoses. We've reduced prescribed opiates since 2013, 51%. We're making some progress there, but we still have a long way to go in that area. And I really hope and believe that we can beat this thing and just say, you know, that we can look back in the past like we do with polio, but the opiate crisis is destroying our society. And that's something that, to me, I'm very passionate about, and I've tried to work on as best I can everywhere I have a chance to try to make a difference in that.
Okay. Kevin Tachi, question for the candidates.
I'm going to stay on the opioid epidemic. You said that we've made progress. What do we need to do to continue making progress? Tell me, both of you, we'll start with you, though, Senator, what areas do we need to fortify, do we need to invest in, whether it's education, whether it's treatment centers, whether it's continued vigilance when it comes to prescriptions and Big Pharma? Where do we start?
Well, prevention and education are really the areas in which I think we're going to make a huge amount of difference in getting into the school systems. And, you know, I've heard a lot of conversations about this, really talking to people at a much younger age about the concerns about messing around with drugs. Drugs are that slippery slope that you go down. And so that's probably one of the main focuses, is prevention and education. And the other thing that I think is really going to make a difference, and we're moving in this direction, it has been sponsored mostly by the private sector. You're starting to see the government play a role in this, and that's life coaches. So when someone becomes addicted, understand they're not going to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. It's not going to happen. When I understood the science of addiction, it just, all of a sudden, a light bulb went on to me, and I realized that these people need long-term help, and those life coaches that stand with people after the 90 days, and they get out of a treatment center, or the 6 months, or the nine months that they're in a treatment center, they need people to stand with them side by side, and that's going to make the difference to them, for them to beat this addiction.
When you talk about as far as education, it's one of the things that I continuously ask any two candidates or three candidates who are in the room with us. How young do we want to go? What's the age? Should the state be looking at maybe some kind of a marketing plan? You look at back when I was growing up, you had Saturday morning cartoons, and that's how I learned what a bill was, stuff like that. Would it be something along those lines, where it's something that the kids are going to understand and get and go, ooh, whether it's a song, whether it's a cartoon parody, whatever it may be, what do we need to do? How young do we go?
It depending on the age of the kid. I mean, that was clever. I remember that as well. Yeah, I think you and I are probably good contemporaries. Yeah, exactly. Do you want to sing?
Maybe later.
Yeah, no. But it is a progressive thing. But I really do think that we need to be, you know, in seventh and eighth grade, you're starting to see kids, you know, start to experiment with drugs. And that's where you need to talk about how dangerous this is and how you're making life-altering decisions. The reality is, though, young people don't understand the consequences of making life-altering decisions. And so we do have to be more creative in how we have that conversation with them about how dangerous messing around with drugs are, because nobody decides that they want to be a drug addict. It's a progression. They play around a little bit, and all of a sudden, and depending on the drug that they use, the opiate that they use, they can literally go from 0 to 100, and that's what's scary about opiates specifically. Some people can take them and be fine. Some people automatically addicted.
Yeah, the addiction trigger, right? Same question. What do you feel needs to be done? We're seeing successes. What do we do to continuously keep the... Where do we need to invest in or target to continue these strengths of successes when it comes to opioids?
One of the things we need to invest in is we need to keep investing in the Attorney General's education program around that's aimed at middle schoolers. I think she has started a great program that is certainly having an effect. How young do you start? I think you're right. I mean, cartoon programming and that, you know, we now have the Cartoon Network, right? Used to be cartoons were Saturday morning, right? Now they're all day long, 7 days a week. So education is definitely a key component, because prevention is the way to go. But the senator's right, you know, that it can be a single dose of an opiate that can cause somebody to become addicted. And so really educating the public, too, around the extent of this disease, that it creates significant long-term changes in the brain. And it's a brain disease that we really need to recognize as a disease and remove the stigma. So that's where we need to go with this. And I think that we're heading in the right direction, and we need to make sure we keep investing in it.
And are you okay with a marketing campaign as well? Do you think that's an idea that maybe the state should take a look at?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's a key issue, because otherwise how are we going to get the word out?
Okay. It's Charles Matthews. Any questions for the candidates?
Well, let's talk smoke. No mirrors. first, Vinny, you've had two opportunities to vote on raising the age to buy tobacco products from 18 to 21. You've not voted in either case. Why is that?
Because I own a gas station. And, of course, at my gas station...
It has a convenience store.
Exactly. And so there would be a conflict of interest. So any time that, you know, over my years in public office, if it specifically has to do with gas stations and convenience stores, I've done that. I would have supported the 21 years of age.
That was my next question.
So I beat you to it. so I would have supported it. But, of course, when you're in that, you just don't want to give anyone even the perception of a conflict of interest, even though I would have supported it. That was the advice that I got from counsel in regards to that, because I certainly do not have a problem at all supporting the independent.
Okay, now to get to the real smoke question. two times you've asked Plymouth Selectmen to put back on the ballot the question of retail marijuana sales in Plymouth. You seem to have then backed off that. Do you regret having done that?
You know, it became clear to me that was not the direction they wanted to go on. I spent a lot of time on this issue. I went to Colorado. I really studied this. I spent a year and a half on it. So I understand, you know, I feel like I have a very good understanding of it. And to me, until we really can address the issue of drug driving, and we have no way to address that. The reality is people are going to drive down the road. Right now they can go and, you know, very shortly purchase, you know, marijuana, cookies, candies, gummy bears. They can, you know, certainly smoke it. And they're going to be driving down the road, and they're going to be impaired, and we don't have the breathalyzer test. So to that extent, that's what makes me concerned. As far as, you know, what people decide to do, I made my case. I've certainly shared my concern. They've chosen not to, and like anything, you make your case and you move on, and that's what I have done. But I did that with every community. I shared with them, listen, I would go slow, because what we heard, and this is the governor of Colorado said, if I were you, I would wait another 2 or 3 years to see how this thing plays out in Colorado before you make this decision.
Deb, do you support retail sales of cannabis? There are a couple of towns in the district.
You know, what I support is regulating cannabis, and I think the way to regulate it is to have control over where you're going to sell it. I think that the local zoning boards and the local towns are in the best position to make those decisions for their towns about where to locate it, and I think that the opportunity for tax revenue that we're going to get from that, those sales, is going to help to boost our ability to deal with treatment of other issues. So I think it's time to move forward. It's not that marijuana is not in our communities. It's there. It's a question of getting control of it and regulating it and getting it out of the black market.
This is a question I hear at town meetings all over the South Shore. We're going to ban marijuana. No, you're not banning marijuana. It's here. So you would say it's a question of regulating it, not fooling yourself into thinking you're banning it.
Right. There's no point in pulling the wool over our own eyes, right? I mean, it's there. It's in our communities. I think you regulate it. I think you regulate it the way you regulate liquor stores, and you have control over it. No public smoking. You know, it's like we have no public drinking. And you do the best you can to have some control. I mean, there's no way we're going to get absolute control, but at least we're moving in the right direction.
Okay, thank you.
I want to go back to opioids for a minute, because I know we were talking a little bit about numbers that came out, and it said it looked like the numbers of opioid deaths were down and also overdoses. Do you think with the availability of Narcan over the counter, and now you can get it without a prescription, and people overdosing in their own homes where those numbers aren't necessarily reported to the state, and also some of the deaths, which through a series of wherever they die, maybe it doesn't get into the right tally where somebody did die from some kind of an overdose. Do you think those are affecting the numbers more, or do you think we're really making progress on the opioid epidemic? Deb?
I think we're really making progress on the opioid epidemic. I think that the work that's been done at the state level has really had a deep impact on that. The general availability of Narcan is relatively new, so I don't think it's really had time to impact those numbers. What I worry about that is, even though it's over the counter, there's still a cost attached to that. So the communities that are going to benefit it from it more are going to be the communities where the people can afford it, and the people that are going to continue to suffer the higher rates of death are going to be the lower income communities where people just don't have the same kind of access.
Do you know how much it costs a dose?
I don't.
It's somewhere between 70 and 100 bucks.
Much? Yeah, okay. It's expensive.
It actually was less. It's become more expensive over a period of time.
It's become more expensive since it was branded as a brand name. It's Naloxone, but
right.
Not.
Yeah, that's right.
Vinny, what do you think about those numbers? Do you think the numbers we're seeing are realistic, or do you think they're being affected by the fact that some people are maybe not getting reported that they did overdose or pass away because of the availability of the drug?
Well, first, I do think that there is making a difference. You can't reduce prescriptions that have been prescribed by 50-some-odd percent and not make some kind of a difference. And the awareness, I think everyone knows a lot more about, this whole crisis than they ever knew. They have neighbors, they have friends, sons, daughters, and so we're more educated, and so that's why we've made a difference. But Narcan has saved people's lives, and that's wonderful, but it is a Band-Aid. The reality is people are using it, and then they're going back, and it's beating the addiction, overdosing and then, coming back. Overdosing and coming back is risky business, and the reality is we have to beat this addiction, and that's a long-term thing. We're getting there, but as I said, we still have a ways to go. It's hard to say this is good news when so many people are still dying, but it is. We are making progress, and I am proud as the Commonwealth of Massachusetts that we joined arms, Republicans and Democrats, to do that.
Right. One of the counselors at one of the drug treatment facilities told me it takes, after somebody who's really had a serious addiction problem, after they get off whatever it is they're on, it takes 5 years for their brain to return to what it was before. That's a pretty scary thought. But I want to go now to Kevin Tachi. Questions for our candidates.
District has its share of coastal issues. What needs to be done by the state regarding rising seas and seawall remediation? And what are you willing to do or continue to do to make sure this remains a priority when it comes to the state and their following through? Senator?
We just did an environmental bond bill that is specifically addresses some of these issues. I think what we all saw what happened in March, you know, storm after storm, and the significance of the damage that had happened. For those of us, speaking of Plymouth Beach there, I mean, it was shocking, the impact of Plymouth Beach down by the waterfront, the wall by, you know, by the where the rock is, totally destroyed. So it clearly, you know, something's happening. So how do we address that? We, you know, coastal resiliency is part of the process, getting the resources. So we have a bond bill that's going to specifically, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars specifically for coastal resiliency, trying to address the issue of climate change. And, you know, the challenge with climate change is doesn't just happen in Massachusetts. It happens on a national or international basis. And so we don't have all that much control, but we can kind of be leaders. And in the Senate, we actually voted for a pretty aggressive climate bill led by Senator Pacheco that creates a market-based the market-based
you don't want the bell, huh?
Yeah, I know. I saw that coming.
I want to follow up with you. So do you feel this is more of a financial-based issue, or do you feel that more study needs to be put into this to kind of get an idea as to what's going on when we're talking about rising seas?
It's not only financial; it's a lifestyle change. It's clearly, I mean, what we're doing in renewable energy is really kind of exciting. I mean, you see that Vineyard Wind and that what's going 800 megawatts of power. We have allowed for 1,600 megawatts of power, and the power that's coming out of there is as competitive dollar for dollar as the natural gas plants or the nuclear. You know, or the nuclear power plants. That's exciting for us because we're able to use renewables and we're competitive financially. So it's both, and it's changing the way that we do business. The next big thing is going to be, you know, energy storage. And when we hit the energy storage issue and we're able to address, because wind obviously is only when it's windy, and it's solar when it's sunny. But when we're able to really tap into, and that's the next area in energy that we can really get into, is energy storage through battery power.
Same question, Deb, in regards to coastal issues, what needs to be done in regards to the state, rising seas, seawall remediation. What are you willing to do to make sure that this remains a top priority when it comes to the state and their follow-through?
Absolutely. Resiliency and remediation are where we have got to go, and I think we're finally getting on board with that. Certainly the state is moving in the right direction in that regard. One of the programs that they have is this municipal vulnerability project that is going on, where each of the towns is eligible to apply for a grant from the state and from the ground up pull in their citizens and identify their own vulnerabilities and their own strengths. And from that, to start putting together what they think will address those problems. Once they complete that project, then they become eligible to apply for state grants that will address that. I actually attended one of these sessions. I attended the training down in Sandwich. To date, only two of the towns in our district have completed that project. So one of my first priorities will be to work with the other four towns in the district to participate in that project, identify their eligibility for grants, and to help them move forward in that regard. Because if we absolutely have to, and I think you know, the people of the district have got to acknowledge what's going to happen if we don't.
Thank you, Rick. You're listening to a WATD Political Forum. The race is for the state Senate seat for the Plymouth-Barnstable District. We have the incumbent Republican, Vinny DiMacedo, here in studio. We also have his Democratic challenger, Deb Rudolph. Let's go to the next question now, Charles Mathewson.
Deb, if you're successful as a freshman senator, how would you stand up to the power of the leadership and go your own way if you think it's necessary?
You know, I'm really good at building alliances and working together with people. It's one of the things I've done my entire life. I would really like to work on the Elder Affairs Committee. I think that committee is critical in terms of our aging demographic. I've worked in the Public Policy Committee for the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys in their Mass chapter. I would also like to work on the Families and Committee. I lost
Children
the name.
And Families.
Children and Families Committee, which is another one of my strengths. But the other thing is to try and get involved also in the Ways and Means, because without the funding, we don't get anywhere. So my focus would really be to bring in the kinds of policies that we really need to be paying attention and to try and bring up things that have maybe not made it through committee and see where do we have to go with those.
Vinny, you have voted with the leader, Bruce Tarr, 96% of 215 votes. That's the highest record of any Republican in the Senate. Why?
Again, it all depends on what the issues are. I mean, Bruce Tarr is probably considered one of the more liberal senators, Republican senators, so I don't necessarily know that that's the case, you know, depending on the issues that you go. As from my perspective, you know, whatever issue comes up, I've had the privilege of being the ranking member on the Committee on Ways and Means, 12 years in the House, 4 years in the Senate. I'm part of the leadership team, and that's because that's such an important part of, you mentioned Ways and Means. That's such an important part of what we do and how we get the budget together. So as far as that goes, if I'm 96%, maybe my other colleagues may be 93, 94%, and, it all depends on what the issues are, but I try to, where I'm on the budget, and a lot of those are when we're dealing with the budget, we tend to agree, because he and I spend a lot of time talking about what we did in regards to the budget.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, all set there? All right. What do you think about single-payer health care, Vinny? Do you support it or not?
Well, we've done universal health care in Massachusetts, and I think it's worked in this private public partnership. Mm-hmm. I'm very concerned about going to a just single payer without the private pay, because the reality is it's so expensive. Vermont tried this model, conversations of $30 million. We have $30 billion, and we have a $41 billion budget. So when you add that extra cost and specifically put it all on the taxpayer, the reality is it's, you're going to have to raise taxes significantly. There's no way around it not to, because, and if you look at a lot of the hospitals, the mix goes, Medicare and Medicaid don't pay the full boat. They get that from the private pay insurances. That's how they're able to balance this out. So what it's going to do is going to increase the costs to the taxpayers, not only from the cost perspective, but it's also going to increase the overall cost. Vermont tried this, and they came out, and they've abandoned it.
Deb, what do you think? Do you go for single-payer health care in Massachusetts? Good idea?
I do go for single-payer health care in Massachusetts, and I think that one of the things that we really need to look at is what are the costs of insurance premiums doing to our families. I think if we can go to a single-payer health care, obviously we would see an increase in taxes, but the decrease in the cost of premiums would actually give a net increase to the average worker's paycheck. And I think everybody would like to see take home a little bit more in their paycheck. The other thing that it does is for providers, there are several different, with so many different insurance companies, providers are constantly having to figure out, which insurance company is requiring which prerequisites and who needs a prior authorization and what kind of form do they want, and another insurance company wants a different form. And you can be dealing with 16, 20, 30 different insurance companies. So it's also a benefit to the providers of healthcare because it would cut down on how they have to manage their reimbursements from the providers, from who's going to pay the cost of the care.
Okay. Let's go, Kevin Tachi. Questions for the candidates for the state Senate seat?
State has always led the nation when it comes to providing a quality education. However, the manner in which funding or Chapter 70 local aid is distributed, aka the funding formula, still remains an issue. What needs to be done to remedy this long-withstanding problem? Deb.
One of the things we need to do is to deal with the way in which Chapter 70 uses property values in order to come to the per student reimbursement rate that they're going to get to. This is especially a problem down on the Cape, where there are so many properties down there that are owned by people who don't live there year round. They really inflate that number, and therefore it looks like those towns don't need as much help as they ought to be getting. And I think that's one of the key areas that we really need to address in looking at how this funding formula works. The formula is out outdated and we need to just take it apart and take a look at it. And I've done that kind of work of looking at statutes and looking at laws. I did that when we had to look at the statewide issues of all the state laws when same-sex marriage went into effect, what had to be. I was part of the task force for the American Bar Association. So I've done that kind of work, and I know how to parse that kind of language and take a look at a state statute and see what we need to do about it.
Senator, would you agree with Deb's assessment of the formula, or do you feel that it's something different?
The formula has clearly had its issues, and it is very city-centric, let's just say, and so this becomes an urban-suburban issue. So our colleagues down here, Republicans and Democrats, are always fighting about we don't get enough. If you go into the cities, you go to the city of Brockton, you know, I mean, it's almost all paid education by there, you know, in most of our regions, 25%, 30%, 40% paid for by the state. And so we don't. The problem is every time you touch it, if you increase here, you're decreasing there. And so the challenge is when you take the city of Boston that has 20-something representatives in this area, you're going to run into this problem. So the only way to really address this issue is when you get new resources, you keep the cities at this level and you start to increase at the local level. That's why we do it per person, so that what you've seen, the way we've addressed it is per person, and we've increased by $25 and $50. Josh Cutler and I consistently have advocated for $50 per person added to for specifically communities in what I call suburban communities.
So here's the thing. How come this hasn't been mentioned before? Is this a conversation that's ongoing? Because I could swear it was just 3 or 4 years ago that there was a conversation that there was a committee that was looking at it, and that they had some kind of a formula update that they were going to institute, and we're still hearing conversations that communities aren't getting their fair share.
It happens every single year. You have that conversation, they go. Matter of fact, in the Senate, it just came right up until the end as far as Sonia Chang Diaz was the chair. The problem is there were suburban communities that were very upset because the lion's share of the money went to what they call disproportionate, you know, communities in regards to their finances. And so there were communities that were in the cities and towns that were certainly, in the suburban areas that didn't get the same. So we're increasing the monies that are going there, but we're not really addressing the suburban communities. We're only addressing the urban communities. And that's the fight that you always have. So every 2 years, and this is why I'm telling you, and everybody says they're going to go and they're going to fix this problem, and I've seen this, the way we have to address it is we have to specifically, try to hold the line there and try to bring up the suburban communities that really do have a load on. That being said, we're at the highest level in education funding from the state to their over $5 billion, which is, you know, a first. And I mean, at least we're trying to address that. Never been a cut. I saw that. Saw those fingers. A lot to talk about.
Such power, Christine.
Watch the fingers.
Look at that.
Crazy.
Huh?
All right. Any follow-ups for those?
No, that's good.
Okay. Charles Matthewson?
Okay, while we're at it, another City Mouse, Country Mouse issue.
Love that book.
We've talked a lot in this studio this season about 40B affordable housing. It's a similar problem. The cities love it. The towns don't. What do you do about it? Vinny, why haven't you solved this problem in 14 years?
Let me just say that I just came today. We were down in Falmouth. Two new affordable housing unit projects, one a 40-unit one, one a 10-unit one, totally supported by the community. And because the community understands that it's a challenge to live, especially on the Cape. It's, you know, it's one of the most beautiful places in the world in regards to people flock there every summer, but they buy second homes. They buy second homes. What does it do? It drives the cost of housing up. So the average person doesn't have the ability to survive there. So we did a $7 million project with assistance from the feds and the state in the town of Falmouth. We just announced it today. And then another $1.3 million project for workforce housing. So the reality is workforce housing, these are people that aren't subsidized at any other level, but they only make a certain amount of money, and they're able to get into this workforce housing. We need that workforce housing. Deb just mentioned this earlier in regards to the fact that, having the employees to work in our restaurants and hotels and all the things are really challenged. And I'm getting the red card.
Deb, how do you address the dreaded 40B, which is not really always addressing affordable housing, but is too frequently maybe helping developers.
Well, I think we need to take an integrated approach in dealing with housing, and that has to do with industry and education and housing. I think if we take a look at, we need to get better at forecasting. What are the industries of the future? Where are the economic drivers going to be? Whether that's high tech or renewable energy or that sort of thing, because we have those kinds of industries we can locate anywhere. And to the degree that you can locate a job provider closer to where the people are living, those people are going to be able to access those jobs and be able to come into them at a younger age. So then we need to look at our education systems, right? Is our secondary education and the immediate post-secondary education providing the kind of education that's going to allow kids who are moving from childhood into adulthood to move into sustainable jobs that are going to pay them a sufficient wage where they're going to be able to afford the local housing? South Shore Chamber of Commerce has an interesting proposal in that regard in order to come up with housing that's going to be located near transportation and jobs, and to put those kinds of things together. And those are the kinds of efforts we need to be looking at.
Okay. Either or both of you, what about, you mentioned workforce housing. Do you think the Cordage attempt is a good one?
Absolutely. You look at just the Cordage example is a perfect example. $2 million in infrastructure from a MassWorks grant from the state. What that did was leverage over $40 million just in the first phase. Going to 100 and some odd units are going to be put in there. 25% of them affordable. They're going to be a second phase. So when those two phases are built out, not only are we getting there, but the town is going to get $800,000 in taxes from that project. And so you look at that, and then beyond that, $3,000 because of the 40R project, $3,000 per unit, another $450,000. So the town, not only did they get $2 million to build this project, but it's also going to leverage a great deal of dollars coming back, and it's right at the end of what we hope to really increase is that transit-oriented type of housing setup. So that's a huge win, let alone what's going to happen on the ocean side, which is going to really increase the tax base.
Deb, are you happy with the workforce housing at Cordage?
I think that they've done a good job in terms of putting together a project down there. One of the problems with affordable housing is if you're looking at housing that costs $200,000, which is certainly way below the average cost of housing, that requires 10% or even a 5% down payment. 5% of $200,000 is $10,000. Somebody who's looking for affordable housing, I don't have $10,000 in the bank that I could put towards that. And I think that that's one of the issues is what is the formula for how people are eligible for this affordable housing or this workforce housing? And we really need to take a serious look at that, because otherwise you can say you've made it available, but if the public who needs it can't access it, then what have we accomplished?
Okay, thank you.
How stable do you think the local economy is? Let's start with you, Deb.
I think in general the local economy is pretty stable. I don't think... Part of that is because we do have some infrastructure that allows us pretty decent access up into Boston. I think we have a lot of commuters who are heading up there. And I think that we have some good local businesses. Certainly, you know, the new minimum wage law, $15 an hour, that's going to go into effect in 4 years. I mean, what is the cost of living going to be in 4 years? I think all of those efforts are moving in the right direction, but I think we need more to support our local economy.
Okay. Benny, how stable do you think the local economy is?
In this region, tourism really our number one driver of the economy, and the tourism industry is pretty strong. And I think over the next couple of years, even going to be stronger. I think when you're going to see happen in 2020, you're going to see people from all over the world looking at where did America start. And I think we're going to see a huge boom from that particular area. And so what do we do with that? How do we do? We have this big party. How does that work out? The reality is we've put together some significant infrastructure. $1.7 million. You see all the beautiful lights down at the waterfront. $3 million for the
Pilgrim State Park, $2 million for the T Wharf for our fishing industry. We have invested significantly in infrastructure because that is how we're going to get, beyond 2020. Another big issue is the dredging, and that's really exciting. You look at $14 million in federal dollars, $2.5 million in the state if the town matches it, another $2.5 million, $19 million in dredging. That place has not been dredged since 1952. That is going to open up a huge economic engine that we have not seen in the Plymouth downtown area, and I think that's pretty exciting.
Okay.
And I know that that was going to go off.
That's right. The bell. Sorry.
I know.
This isn't my a question, but just a follow-up. You mentioned dredging.
Yeah.
Are you going to use the county dredge?
Yeah, it's a much bigger project than the county dredge.
Okay.
Obviously,
it was more of a rhetorical question.
County dredges for ponds.
Yeah.
Charlie may want to kind of chime in on this, but one of the conversations that we have, knowing that your part of your district has Pembroke and Kingston and Plymouth, we're talking a little bit about water. And while I don't know where it stands on the state senate level, there have been previous conversations in regards to Silver Lake, City of Brockton, and its use. Where does that issue stand with your particular seat, your district? What are you hearing from your constituents in regards to that? Are you being pulled at to take a look at this issue and put some legislation together? Brockton, through a century-old legislation, has ownership of Silver Lake, but we know that there have been ongoing issues not only with Silver Lake, but some of the surrounding ponds and brooks in regards to the use, and people are fearing that there could be issues with Silver Lake down the road with the management that Brockton has been managing it. Senator?
No question, and it is something that we've done. As a matter of fact, I think if you talk to Selectman Bill Bolter, who's actually a supporter of mine from Pembroke and endorsed me, has really appreciated the work that we've done, because this is one of the few times that Brockton is finally starting to listen to us. They've had legislation that has worked in their favor for many years, which is discouraging, and they've been able to kind of get around us. But the DEP has come in there, and the reality is they're seeing that it's actually had a significant impact on the ponds, on Ponset Pond, Silver Lake, and the like. And so you see the problems. I mean, every year the town of Pembroke comes to me if I can get, $25,000 or $50,000
treatment
of these ponds. And we've done it, but the problem's a lot bigger problem. And so we're starting to make some progress there, and the town, the city of Brockton is finally starting to pay attention where they haven't paid attention for a long time because they didn't have to. And we're trying to do the best we that we can to force them.
But are we talking about implementing some legislation or some amendments to the current legislation? And does this mean that it ends up incurring a fight with their legislative delegation who are passionate about it and feel as though, it's an urban-suburban type issue?
Every action has a reaction, and so that's what you're going to run into. So that's why you have to do it corporately, together, and work together with them, and understand that, listen, we have to be fair. They have water needs that are significant. They have a desalinization plant that can could help some.
Debatable.
But they're cost related to that, and that's why they don't look in that area. But they also are just looking at, from their perspective, they have all those needs. And so that's where you run into that challenge. But you have to work, and I've worked closely with the entire Plymouth County delegation, and so that's how we're going to address that problem together.
Same question. What's your knowledge of this particular issue in regards to Silver Lake, East Westman Ponson Pond, any legislation? Again, City of Brockton is allowed to manage Silver Lake, but there have been problems, especially while we've had droughts and issues. What's your understanding of this, and what are you willing to do if you're elected?
I don't have a deep understanding of this. Certainly clean water is an issue for the district-wide. We all have this issue of clean water, and everybody's fighting for their little piece of the pie. And I think when any community that has control over a source of water, of course, is going to want to continue to control that. And I think what becomes pertinent to the members of the legislature is to figure out how to work together, that we all need clean water. The aquifer is a delicate, balanced environment, and we need to figure out how to protect it for all of the members of our cities and towns. And it's not just a local issue, it's a regional issue, and we need to continue to build our relationships so that we can be effective working together so that we can all have access to clean water.
Okay, I want to go to lightning round now. Lightning round questions for the candidates. Charles Mathewson.
Okay, related. Should Brockton hook up to the MWRA? Vinny?
Yes.
Deb?
Yes.
Lightning round question, Kevin.
One word that best describes you.
Deb?
Compassionate.
Vinny?
I hope honest.
Okay. Ranked choice voting, good idea or not? Two sentences. Deb?
Oh, great idea. I think that ranked choice voting starts with the notion that if you don't get at least 50% of the vote, then you ought to be looking further down the line, and this creates a system that really helps you get there.
Okay, Vinny, what do you think, ranked choice voting?
Yeah, intrigued, interested, still have to see it play out, but for the most part, yes.
Okay, and I have to say this because it is a forum, and I know Dan Pallone is listening.
Plymouth County, Christine.
Plymouth County government, stay or time to go? Vinny?
You know, I think that has potential. It has potential. There's been issues there, but I'm not ready to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Okay, Deb Rudolph.
I really think we need to look at regionalization and how we're dealing with that. And I think, you know, Barnstable County, Barnstable Region, has certainly been working in terms of getting there.
Okay, we're going to go to our closing statements now. We're going to reverse the order. So we're going to go to Vinny first, then we're going to go to Deb, and you've got 1 minute for your closing statement.
Okay. Again, thank you for the opportunity for us to be here to debate the issues that are important to this region. And I just ask that the people of the Plymouth and Barnstable District to ask them to give me another shot over the next 2 years. For the 4 years that I've served them, I've worked hard on their behalf. I think we've been able to accomplish a lot of things that were really important. I mean, I talked about the issue of the Plymouth 400. I talked about the issue of the Nuclear Decommission. I talked about opiates. All of those things were priorities of my community that I've delivered on. And I believe that if you give me another 2 years, I'm going to continue to deliver. And an issue that I know that was really important to this region was an issue in regards to the Talking Information Center. Many people knew that that program was going to be abolished. I used my relationships on Beacon Hill, Republicans and Democrat, House and Senate, to be able to find a way to save that program. And it's in cooperation and collaboration. I think I've done that, and I've been successful in that. And that's why I'm asking the people of the Plymouth and Barnstable District to give me another opportunity to serve them over the next 2 years, and I am asking for their vote on November 6th.
Thank you. That was Vinny DiMacedo, and just for full disclosure, I am a 30-year volunteer with the Talking Information Center and currently serving as the chairman of the board of TIC. So let's go now to closing statement for Deb Rudolph.
Thank you, WATD. This is always an amazing experience. I love coming here and being able to have this opportunity to let people hear where I'm from, what I'm about. I'm a new voice and a new face, and I think especially with a democratically controlled legislature, I offer the opportunity to go up there and get on the inside of the inside with real solutions for real people. I think looking at the record is what it's all about, and I think looking at the voting record where the senator has voted against restoring funding for mental health care for toddlers and preschoolers, and against the job stabilization project, and against any number of other progressive issues, those are the places where I think I can make the biggest difference for those who are most vulnerable. So I'm asking the people of the Plymouth and Barnstable District to vote for me and to send a new voice, not a political voice, but a voice that has deep roots in the community to represent our voice up there in Beacon Hill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was Deb Rudolph. You listened to both candidates tonight. You have the incumbent Republican, that's Vinny DiMacedo, and you have his Democratic challenger, Deb Rudolph, and that's the Plymouth and Barnstable State Senate District. Of course, stay tuned to WATD. We'll bring you complete coverage on election night, November 6th. Thank you, Kevin Tachi. Thank you, Charles Mathewson. Thank you, Whitman Hanson, Community Access TV, and our own Amy Leonard. Remember, get out and vote. If you don't vote, you don't have a voice. I'm Christine James on 95.9 WATD.